This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Well, welcome everyone to episode 62 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Mike Morrison, and with me, as he always is Zachary Frühling. Today we're going to be discussing the ethics of invisibility. Zachary, how are you today?
I'm okay. Are you really sure I'm here with you tonight? Do you have any visible evidence that I'm actually here?
Well, I've got to tell you, I bought a personal cloaking device for this episode, so if I blink out, just don't sweat it. Just keep going. I'm still here. And I've got confidence that you're there. I don't know if you invested in a cloaking device for this episode, but I trust if you blink out, as long as I can see your headphones, I know you're still there.
Well, I see your glasses and your headphones, but I can't see your expressions.
Oh, it works then. Wonderful. Seems to be functioning within normal parameters.
Well, we have kind of a fun topic for you guys on Metatrex here today. A little while ago, I was watching the Lord of the Rings trilogy, and that got me thinking about Plato's Ring of Gyges, a myth involving an invisibility ring, which is a precursor to the Lord of the Rings. And that got me thinking about invisibility, and that got me thinking about cloaking devices. So today on Metatrex, we are going to talk about Plato's Ring of Gyges as it relates to Romulan and Klingon cloaking devices.
Yeah, this is going to be a lot of fun because there are a lot of similarities between the Ring of Gyges, of course, Lord of the Rings, The Invisible Man. All of these are kind of modern takes on Plato's story, which is really kind of this interesting thought experiment about the ethics of humanity and what would happen if a person were to become invisible and not necessarily have to restrain himself or herself, ethically because of their invisibility. What would the results be? What would they abandon their ethics? Would they abandon their morals? Or, you know, would they cling to that? And you're absolutely right. I think about the Romulans, and I think there's a really interesting, and for that matter, the Klingons, I think there's something really interesting there that we can take a look at in terms of their behavior as a species in the Star Trek universe.
Well, I think you can learn a lot about human nature or individual people by asking, what would they do if they were invisible, if they had, you know, the ring from Lord of the Rings or Plato's Ring of Gyges, or if they had a personal cloaking device where they couldn't be seen? Would they continue to be moral people, helping other people, being nice, not getting praise, or would their morality devolve into, you know, stealing and prowling and all the things they could get away with while they were invisible because there are no consequences? And this discussion from Plato's Republic is really interesting. So if you remember, Plato's Republic is a dialogue about justice. And inside that dialogue, the main character of Socrates is discussing or debating the nature of justice with several interlocutors. And one of the people he's talking to is named Glaucon. And Glaucon gives this interesting account of this myth of the Ring of Gyges. So really quickly, let me give you a summary of this story. So even though the Ring of Gyges is actually a myth, Gyges of Lydia was actually a historical king. He was the founder of the Mirbna dynasty of Lydian kings. In Glaucon's retelling of the myth of the Ring of Gyges, some unnamed ancestor of Gyges was a shepherd in the service of the current king of Lydia. After an earthquake, a cave was revealed in a mountainside where he was feeding his flock. Entering the cave, this ancestor discovered that it was in fact a tomb with a bronze horse containing a corpse bigger than that of a human. And this corpse wore a golden ring, which the ancestor pocketed. He stole the ring. And he discovered that this ring gave him the power to become invisible by adjusting the ring. Similar to what you see in Lord of the Rings, you know, when, mm-hmm. when Bilbo, you know, or Frodo puts the ring on, they become invisible. And so with this newfound power of invisibility, this ancestor of Gyges arranged to be chosen as one of the messengers who reported to the king. And when he arrived at the palace, he used this power of invisibility to seduce the queen. And with her help, he murdered the king and took his place as the king of Lydia. And hence, eventually, Gyges of Lydia, inheriting the ring, was king of Lydia, ring and all. But the basic idea is that, you know, this ring has this seductive power of making you do bad things. You know, once this ancestor of Gyges realized that he had the power to be invisible, he realized, hey, I can take the king's place and no one will even notice. I can murder the king. I can seduce the queen. I can steal the riches. I can just become the king for all intents and purposes. And that's exactly what happened. But I think this core idea is that invisibility is somehow corrupting. Either that invisibility is corrupting, or perhaps that it reveals this inner human nature that, free of any consequences, you know, we're naturally drawn towards doing bad or evil things because we don't have to deal with any consequences of our actions.
Yeah, that's one of the posits, I think, of the Ring of Gyges, is that given the ability to become invisible, a person would not be able to refrain from stealing something that wasn't his, because after all, no one will see me. I'm not only invisible, I'm invincible.
And that exactly is Glaucon's argument inside the Republic. He basically says that, you know, absent of any consequences, when you're given this power of invisibility, we're inevitably drawn towards doing wrong. And Socrates basically replies by saying, well, not necessarily. If you let your animal passions govern your actions, even when you're invisible, then you're delving into the depths of I don't want to say despair, but you're delving into the depths of moral chaos, right? You know, you're being governed as if you're an animal rather than being ruled by your reason. So he says that, you know, if you've mastered the art of understanding what goodness is and justice is philosophically, then even when you don't have to worry about consequences, even if you were given an invisibility ring, mm-hmm. you would be in control of your passions and you would be happier because you wouldn't be governed by those animal passions and you would still do the right thing even if you were invisible. But only if you've trained yourself to govern your passions with your reason.
I love that, you know, here we are in ancient Greece, and Plato writes this crazy, awesome science fiction.
About ancient Klingons and ancient Romulans.
And to kind of bring it progressively into our own modern world, you know, H.G. Wells wrote The Invisible Man, which is very similar, and it postulates some of the same things that Plato is dealing with here. And, you know, Griffin, for instance, is the character, as I recall, in The Invisible Man. I love H.G. Wells. He's doing all of this research in optics, and he comes up with a way to make the refracting principles of the human body the same as air. But he's unable to reverse the process. So he's basically living invisible now. And what it does to him deep in his soul is it darkens him, and he becomes a very dark and he almost has a psychotic breakdown as a result of it. I mean, he becomes so dark and sinister a character. And as we've already mentioned, Lord of the Rings, Bilbo Baggins, The Hobbit, you know, Tolkien does such an amazing job of taking, you know, the Ring of Gyges and rewriting it and telling, you know, a bit of a more modern tale that really conveys, again, some of the same ideas that Plato's dealing with. And then we come to, you know, the Star Trek universe, and we have two species within the Star Trek universe that has the technology to render their ships invisible. And we get to deal all over again in the Star Trek universe with the ethical implications of that kind of technology.
And have you noticed that Klingon looks a little bit like Elvish?
They do look rather Elvish.
Not the Klingons, the actual Klingon language, the script.
Yeah, oh, yeah, it does. It actually
does. Romulans look a little Elvish.
The Romulans look Elvish, yes. Yeah, somewhere out there, I'm sure that there is a sub-commander Bilbo Baggins. That's in my head canon.
Well, I think what's interesting about these different tellings of this basic story, what invisibility does to morality, starting with Plato's Ring of Gyges, going all the way to Lord of the Rings, you know, with the Invisible Man there in the middle, you basically kind of pivot between two viewpoints on this. One viewpoint, I think, is that human nature is corrupting, that that the ring really has nothing to do with it, or the invisibility. It's that our inner nature leads us to a default path of doing wrong left to our own devices, you know, absent of consequences and absent visibility. I think the other position on this, and this is really the position that Tolkien takes and what he adds to the story, is that the ring itself in The Lord of the Rings is corrupting, right? It's this seductive, active power that is drawing the bearer closer and closer to evil. So it's not like the protagonist or the person wearing the ring is drawn to evil based on his or her innate nature, but evil is seductive inside Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely, I think, an element that you don't see in Ring of Gyges, you don't see in The Invisible Man, and certainly don't see in the Star Trek universe, this idea that there is an evil tied to the ring itself, and by putting the ring on is introducing oneself to that evil and being drawn, seduced by that evil. And so that is a rather unique element.
But because this is a Star Trek and philosophy podcast, we're not going to dwell too much on Plato's Ring of Gyges, and we're not going to dwell too much on The Invisible Man, and we're not going to dwell too much on The Lord of the Rings. We're going to talk about cloaking devices and the morality involved in those.
Yes, and Zachary, I think probably my primary question when I think about cloaking technology, and obviously we really have nothing within the Star Trek universe to answer these questions, but my primary question is, to what degree does that cloaking technology inform the morality and the ethics of the Romulans and the Klingons? Are they morally and ethically the species they are as a result of the cloaking technology, or is it the reverse?
I'm not sure we're going to be able to answer such a general question, but I think it does inform some of their behavior inside the Star Trek universe.
Certainly.
You know, if you look at the way that Klingon ships and Romulan ships are always doing incursions into Federation space, it reminds me very much of someone who's just discovered an invisibility ring kind of poking their head in the windows, right? Oh, I wonder if I can crack this window open. I wonder if I can run off with some, you know, valuables from someone's home because no one will see me. So I'm going to poke and prod and see where I can go, what I can get away with this invisibility cloak. And that reminds me very much of how the Klingons and Romulans operate on the border of their territory in Federation space. They're always prodding and poking and scheming, and they're always popping up in places you don't expect them to be. And it, so, you know, I'm not sure if it informs their, you know, their deep-seated morality or is a causal factor for that. I think it'll be hard to determine whether the ability to cloak is a causal factor for their morality. Is that a driving causal factor that accounts for the Romulan and Klingon moral worldview? Or does their cloaking ability kind of reveal their inner nature, just like we see in the Ring of Gyges? But I do think that it informs their behavior. You definitely can see Klingons and Romulans trying to get away and poke and prod and scheme and see what they can get away with.
When I think about cloaking technology with the Klingons, I can't help but think about Star Trek VI. And that amazing scene where that Klingon bird of prey is cloaked and it's firing on the Enterprise. It was a good thing that Sulu showed up with the Excelsior, because I mean the Enterprise was taking a beating, and this was really, I think, one of Uhura's shining moments. She comes up really with this kind of idea that they could fire a torpedo with a sensory array on it that would sense the gas, and she says, you know, that thing's got to have a tailpipe, and they were able to identify it, lock on, and fire against it. But
do you think that would have worked back in Plato's time? You know, someone might have said, hey, Gyges has to have a tailpipe. He's got to go to the bathroom sometime. We'll just sit around, we'll wait, and then we'll blow him up while he's in there.
Yeah, it's like, you know, right there in Star Trek VI, it's like the Ring of Chang, you know, and he's sitting there on the bridge firing away, you know, spinning around in his chair, quoting Shakespeare, and just firing, you know, torpedo after torpedo. But again, thank God for Uhura. She figured out how to out him so that they could fire. But you know, there he's using that cloaking technology in a very sinister way. There's no morality in the way that he's fighting. He's kind of thrown the rules of engagement out the door. Prior to this, a Klingon bird of prey can't fire cloaked, and there's really no honor in sitting there cloaked and firing on your enemy. I mean, he's just lost all sense of honor.
Yeah, but isn't this a bit like the British criticizing the American revolutionaries for not being willing to stand in a line and get shot? Like, you know, for actually doing guerrilla warfare and like hiding behind a tree and being smart and then shooting rather than just standing in a line? I mean, that argument can't hold up.
I just, you know, I wonder though, and I think this is a really good question because, you know, like we've talked about, we're not really going to be able to answer the broad question of, you know, this kind of chicken or the egg, does the cloaking technology inform the species or vice versa? But here is a question I really think that, you know, we can sit and have some fun with, and that is, given what we know about Klingons and their sense of honor, how honorable would the Klingon Empire consider Chang to be using a cloaking device to destroy a ship?
Are you saying that maybe they designed their ships that way on purpose, that they can't fire while cloaked because to do so would be dishonorable? That can't be right.
No, I think it's probably a technological limitation, but
I love the idea that it's a matter of honor. Like, no, we have to uncloak to fire because that's more honorable.
Yeah, I don't think that's the case. I think it's a limitation of technology.
It's not the bird of prey that can't fire while cloaked. It's the Klingons that
can't fire
while cloaked.
Uncloak. We want them to see the whites of our eyes. Gowron with his crazy eyes. But Chang is doing something, I think, that really lets us know that he's kind of gone off the rails as a Klingon. Something that I think many Klingons would consider dishonorable. And that is to remain cloaked, and it almost seems cowardly to remain cloaked and fire on a ship instead of facing off in an honorable way in combat. I don't know, maybe I'm reaching here, but my understanding of Klingons and Klingon culture leads me to believe that many, not all Klingons, because you have the Klingons, you know, the Duras family that kind of seem to be this long line of dishonorable Klingons. But I think by and large, most Klingons would consider that to be somewhat dishonorable to behave that way. And I think like the protagonist in the Ring of Gyges, like the protagonist in Griffin in The Invisible Man, much like we see in Lord of the Rings, having that technology and now being able to fire a torpedo while cloaked, in some ways, I think, has caused Chang to kind of go beyond the point of no return in terms of his own personal honor. And so he's willing to plan the assassination of the Chancellor, undermine the Federation. I mean, he's not only gone to all-out war against the Federation, I mean, he's declared war on the Klingon Empire because of the seduction of that kind of power.
Well, I think with the Klingons, you can make an argument that their honor is kind of an overriding factor, that their system of honor kind of keeps their behavior, even while cloaked, somewhat in check. And frankly, we just learn a lot more about Klingon culture than we do about Romulan culture. So it's a little hard to make a comparison. But the Romulans always struck me as being a little more like thieves in the night. Like, you never know where they're going to show up. They're willing to use that invisibility to scheme. Whereas Klingons do want to reveal themselves and show their honor and then attack or then carry out their scheme.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that. Because in TNG especially, we see these instances in which you know, the Enterprise is near the neutral zone and they're on patrol or they're heading to a star base or whatever the case may be, and they catch a distortion on their sensor array, and then all of a sudden, and it's never just one Romulan warship, it's always two or three, and they just, it's this element of surprise. They decloak, and you know, Picard has that kind of you know, oh crud look on his face, and red alert. It's too late. They've got the drop on. And that seems to be the way the Romulans operate. Klingons are more head on. We tend to see Klingons using their cloak while they're traveling so they can travel without incident. Romulans tend to use their cloak to get the drop on their enemies. I don't know. Maybe I'm reading too much into it. Maybe I'm forgetting some key accounts within the Star Trek universe, but that seems to be the case that we see most often. The Klingons will use their cloak for travel so that they don't have incident. Romulans, on the other hand, will use it to sneak up on their enemy and get the drop on them.
And I think the most important thing to remember when we're talking about Klingons and Romulans in this regard is that really the Klingons and Romulans are humans, right? Humans in Star Trek are these idealized, perfect humans that don't make very many mistakes. Mm-hmm. And here in the real world, we make lots of mistakes and we do lots of bad things. And, you know, we do tend to, you know, get away with things when we think we're not going to get caught. And, you know, so really the Klingons and the Romulans are us. So, you know, what's interesting to me is, can we learn anything about our actual human nature from Klingons and Romulans in Star Trek, or from the way humans are portrayed? What we don't see very much inside Star Trek is the contrast between what Klingons and Romulans would do with the cloaking device and what humans would do with the cloaking device, because we don't see human cloaking devices very much. We see it a little bit in Deep Space Nine, and we see it a little bit in Star Trek The Next Generation, maybe a couple of other places, but, you know, the number of instances that we see humans empowered with a cloaking device is pretty small in Star Trek. And so I'm curious about the contrast. The example that comes to mind is the example from Star Trek The Next Generation in the episode of The Pegasus, when Starfleet has developed secretively, you know, violating a treaty, developed a cloaking device that, in this case, it's a special cloaking device that doesn't just cloak you, but it lets you go through matter as well. But, you know, what would humans do if they had the same capacity that Romulans and Klingons do to become invisible? Would they remain these virtuous Federation citizens and Starfleet members who don't break treaties, and they don't go out and fire on other vessels, and they don't board other ships, they don't try to get away with stuff because of this invisibility? Or would, if the Federation and Starfleet had this invisibility cloak, you know, by default, if they were somehow, if that treaty went away and they were somehow empowered with this new device on all their ships, would Starfleet devolve into what we see the Klingons and the Romulans doing with their cloaking technology? And I think Admiral Pressman's argument inside the Pegasus is actually really interesting. He basically says, look, this treaty has held our hands. We're the good guys. We should have this cloaking technology too, because we're not going to be Klingons and Romulans with it. We're the good guys, and this treaty has tied our hands, and really that's not fair and just, and we should have this technology too. But the very fact that Pressman is willing to violate the treaty to get that technology shows this slippery slide into doing wrong all for the sake of this cloaking device.
Yeah, and I think there's something really interesting there in Pressman's argument, and that is the assumption that absolute power will not corrupt absolutely.
Well, the humans are beyond absolute corruption because of power, right? Exactly. Humans have evolved, you know, so far in the 24th century.
Exactly. And you mentioned Deep Space Nine. So that is the other place in which we see humans have that technology. And of course, the Defiant is equipped with a cloaking device that is on loan from the Romulans. It represents kind of a cooperation that exists between the Federation and the Romulan Empire in order to do reconnaissance in the Gamma Quadrant.
Where are the Organians? What the heck?
Exactly. Somebody needs to show up and put a stop to this.
Chaos run rampant.
But, you know, even then, it's interesting to me that there are aspects that the Romulans are still trying to still trying to cover up, still trying to hold on to those state secrets, even though they've loaned this to the humans. They've got a Romulan commander on the Defiant, and she's not really quick to give up any state secrets regarding the device, and they find themselves in some sticky situations, and she's reluctantly having to tell them, you know, different procedures that they have to, you know, kind of do in order to remain undetectable by the Jem'Hadar.
And I think in Deep Space Nine, the argument goes something like this. We're still the good guys. We're fighting this just war against this evil power. Mm-hmm. And we're justified in doing these acts of war under an invisibility cloak because we're still the good guys. Does that argument really hold up? Or is there a qualitative difference there between what the Romulans ordinarily do and what the Klingons do with their system of honor and human nature? Does that argument really hold water? Or is there something wrong with it?
No, I think it's a viable argument, but unfortunately we really don't get to see that argument kind of explored in the Star Trek universe, because it seems that in Deep Space Nine the cloak is only used in reconnaissance situations. They never, to my knowledge, they never use it offensively.
I asked the question, Mike, because I can imagine the 5th century BC version of this. You know, Gaiji's ancestor says, that evil king is doing all these terrible things, so I am going to be the savior. I'm going to put this invisibility ring on. I'm going to murder the king, seduce his wife, become the king, and I'm going to be a good king. But you're right, the analogy doesn't hold if under invisibility cloak, the Defiant is only doing reconnaissance. They're not doing acts of war per se, or being tyrannical, or overthrowing a government, or raping and pillaging and plundering.
Yeah, and I think it's a missed opportunity, because as we've talked about many times here on Metatrex, and as we've discussed around the Trek FM network, Commander Sisko, Captain Sisko, one of the things that really kind of makes his character unique is that he pushes the boundaries in this wartime situation. And he makes some decisions that some would think were questionable. He kind of pushes the limits of ethics, of morality. And again, as we've talked about many times, the consequences always seem to work out. And one could argue that, okay, so those actions were justifiable. I think we missed an opportunity here to put him in a situation where he needs to decide whether or not he's going to use that cloak in a tactical situation that would put him on the offensive and wrestle with that, because I think that would have been interesting. And frankly, I would be interested to see at the end of the day what he actually decides to do.
I would really have liked to have seen the mental and emotional and moral struggle of Captain Sisko thinking, oh my God, I've turned into a Romulan.
Yeah. I mean, why not? Because
he's a Varul.
Because again, he has this technology, Zachary, and it's war. I mean, he's in a state of war with an enemy who, I mean, one of the first acts of war we see the Jem'Hadar really do, they do a kamikaze mission. They slam one of their ships into a galaxy-class ship and blow it up when it's retreating. And so the stakes are very high in this Dominion War. We've seen that. And so you put Sisko in a situation where maybe it's an admiral saying, you know, we've decided that you need to use the Defiant and that cloaking device in an offensive in order to gain a tactical advantage.
As I think about this a little further, it strikes me that the fact that the Defiant is under invisibility cloak in a state of war is actually kind of a complicating factor, because it makes it seem noble, right? If you're in a state of war where it's us versus them, then anything it takes to get the job done seems noble and seems right. And I think we learned this when we were talking previously about Thomas Hobbes and the state of nature, that, you know, when it's us versus them and you're back in the state of nature outside of civilized society or in a state of war, then an ordinary rule rules of morality don't apply, because those rules only take place inside of a civilized society in a state of peace, not in a state of war. So it makes anything that Captain Sisko does seem right and seem noble. So a more interesting, deeper question to me is, suppose the war with the Dominion had ended, regardless of, you know, whether the invisibility cloak played a role or not. And suppose that for some reason Starfleet and Captain Sisko and the Defiant were allowed to keep the invisibility cloak.
Or refuse to give it up.
Not even that. So you suppose, okay, you know, the Romulans say, okay, you helped us win the war and you can keep your cloak and whatever the arrangement is. The Organians decide it's not a big deal anymore and they let them keep the cloak. And now it's a time of peace. And Captain Sisko decides to go on vacation and he takes the Defiant and he's roaming around the galaxy in the Defiant, and it's invisible because he's got the cloaking device on. And what would Captain Sisko do in that situation? Do you think he would poke and prod and start to act like a Romulan and see what he could get away with if he had total command of the ship outside of Starfleet, outside of a time of war? He's got the Defiant all to himself. The Defiant's invisible. What would Captain Sisko do in that situation?
I can see him, Zachary,
over a period of time, like a month or a year or 5 years.
Yeah, I can see him spinning around in the chair, firing torpedoes at will, shouting "Cry havoc!" and "Let slip the dogs of war." It just the technology's just caused him to go completely off the rails.
I think even less dramatic than that, though. Do you think he would? I mean, let's give him a little credit. Let's say he's generally a moral person. He's not going to kill. He's not going to rape and pillage and plunder, right? He's not going to do those kinds of things because Sisko's generally a good guy. Do you think he would start to break a bunch of little rules, though? Do you think he'd go visit some archaeological sites he's not allowed to visit? Do you think he would, you know, that kind of thing? Do you think he would use that to his advantage in some way that's not normally allowed? Would he break the little rules first?
Well, archaeological sites, so that's more Picard.
Picard or Vosh. But
Picard shows up and says, "I'd like to borrow the Defiant."
Well, I'm kind of thinking Picard. Let's just plug Picard into the situation. Suppose Picard had the Defiant and it had the cloaking device. It doesn't have to be Sisko, right? That's really a bit tangential to the example. Let's suppose Captain Picard is on the Defiant. He's got to keep the invisibility cloak. And now, and Picard's not going to rape and pillage and plunder either.
Right.
But he might go visit an archaeological site. That's a totally plausible thing that Captain Picard would do to abuse the power of a cloaking device.
Yeah, I mean, we could sit here and come up with all kinds of things that each captain would do if they got their hands on the Defiant device.
Captain Kirk would seduce the Queen. he might actually be Gaiji's ancestor.
Perhaps you're right. Of course, we've already mentioned Picard would probably loot some archaeological site.
No. In my retelling of Plato's Stepchildren, Captain Kirk goes back in time and ends up becoming Gaiji's ancestor and seduces the Queen.
Okay.
That's in my new
headcanon. A total retelling of Plato's Stepchildren, yeah.
Okay, so Captain Kirk would seduce someone. That's a given. Captain Picard would visit an archaeological site.
Yes.
Captain Sisko would fill in the blank. And it doesn't have to be something immoral. I'm probing to see if he would actually start violating some rules and start acting a little more immorally with the invisibility cloak.
I don't know. It'd have to be something with baseball, I would imagine.
He would violate the rules of baseball? Well, okay, you could imagine. No, seriously, this is I'm only saying this half jokingly. Suppose that in Take Me Out to the Holosuite, an episode of Deep Space Nine that focuses on baseball and the holodeck, suppose that someone had snuck in a personal cloaking device into the baseball game, into the holodeck. Would Captain Sisko have been willing to use that cloaking device to gain an advantage in the baseball game?
Well, Zachary, he is the emissary of the prophets, so I can see him using the Orb of Time, taking the Defiant, and going back and watching Buck Bakai play in the World Series.
But that's not breaking any rules, though, so that's okay. Well, he might be violating the Temporal Prime Directive or something.
Yeah, but Sisko only breaks the rules in times of war. Otherwise, he's pretty moral guy.
Do you remember that old TV show Out of This World where the girl's father is an alien and she can put her fingers together and stop time? Do you remember that? It's way back in the day. You know,
younger listeners aren't
going
to... That's in the Wayback Machine, yes.
Yeah, younger listeners aren't going to get this reference at all. But I can picture Captain Sisko with the Orb of Time, you know, putting his fingers together and stopping time and messing with the game to get one up on Captain Solok. I could kind of see that, but it would be very much like out of this world.
Yeah, he definitely had it in for Solok. He starts twitching and just at the mention of his name. So Janeway. Okay, so Janeway has access to the Defiant's cloaking device. What's she going to do?
Oh, I know the answer to this. She would sneak some replicator rations and get that morning cup of coffee. She would just sneak right on in there into the mess hall, use the replicator, and out she goes. That's not with the Defiant, but if she had a personal cloaking device, that's what she would do.
Okay, so we've evolved into personal cloaking devices.
Sure, same difference.
Same difference. Okay, absolutely. Okay. So what's your thoughts on Captain Archer?
I know exactly what he would do. He would knock T'Pol in her ass once in a while. So most of these things we're talking about are pretty minor things. Stealing a cup of coffee, knocking T'Pol in her ass because she deserves it. You know, Captain Kirk, you know, he might seduce someone. That might be a little more serious. Who knows? But those are relatively minor things in the grand scheme of things, right? They're not raping and pillaging and plundering. Do you think that eventually, over time, even people as noble and pure and 23rd and 24th century-like as the various captains in Starfleet would eventually experience the moral decay akin to the Ring in Lord of the Rings or the Ring of Gyges?
I think the easy answer is to say, and again, if you're looking at Lord of the Rings, if you're looking at The Invisible Man, if those inform your thoughts on the matter, then the simple answer is yes, because ultimately that kind of power would corrupt one's sense of morality. But I also happen to think that there are people who, I'm not going to say are above reproach, but I do believe that it is within us to resist the temptations to use power for evil.
Well, I think this is basically Socrates' response to Glaucon inside the Republic. Socrates basically says, look, we have the ability to control our passions, to become aware of what's right and wrong, and to govern ourselves accordingly. And not everyone's going to be able to do that. So sure, some people give them an invisibility ring or give them a cloaking device, and they're going to go off and have this moral decay. But certain people are able, either by temperament or through training and through experience, through knowledge, through moral improvement, are able to learn from the past, able to understand what's right and what's wrong, and even under invisibility cloak, even with a cloaking device, will continue to do the right thing. And we see this in the real world. I mean, there are people who do things for the right reasons and do things knowing they'll never get praised for it, knowing that it will never be seen by anyone, and those people do the right things under their quote-unquote invisibility cloak here in the real world because they don't, you know, the consequences of their actions aren't seen and they're not praised for it, and it's essentially done through anonymity and invisibility. And we do see acts of altruism here in the real world, I think.
Zachary, I think we get a really interesting look at this. Although we're not using cloaking technology, in the Next Generation episode, Hiding Q, Q endows Riker, tempts Riker with the power of the Q. And we get to see what that does to Riker, and in a very short amount of time, Riker almost succumbs to the darkness that is within that power, and he really instills some fear. People look at him differently. He looks at himself differently, and he thinks that he can buy their loyalty and buy their friendship with this ability that he's been given. And so there are some similarities, I think, between the Ring of Gyges and what we see in Hide and Q, although we're not dealing with invisibility, but rather omnipotence.
I think that's an interesting compare and contrast because there are some similarities. There are no consequences in that sense, right? If you are omnipotent, then you don't really have to deal mm-hmm. with any consequences of your actions in any meaningful way. On the other hand, there seems to be a structural difference, at least, because in the case of the invisibility ring, or in the case of the cloaking device, there are no consequences because the consequences are invisible. You know, people don't even know that it's you doing the actions, right? They can't see you. They can't see your ship. So it's really anonymous. So that's why there are no consequences.
Sure.
In the case of omnipotence, like with Q or a member of the Q continuum or Riker being given the power of the Q, it's almost the exact opposite situation. It's no consequences because you're omnipotent. You can go, ha ha ha, here I am. Look at all the evil I can do. You can't touch me. Mm-hmm. And it's massively visible. It's out there for the whole world to see, as opposed to living in shadows and darkness like you see in Lord of the Rings or in the case of the cloaking device.
Yeah, and we see Q occasionally abusing his powers when he's kind of hiding, if you will. He's not manifested himself, but yet, you know, they suspect that he's around because, you know, something has changed in the universe that gives them this indication that something supernatural is at work. And so, you know, it automatically brings them to the conclusion that, well, it must be Q. And so I would have to guess that within time, somebody's going to figure out, you know, oh, Captain Sisko has this cloaking technology and, you know, it's a Federation ship, it's Federation weapon signature, so it must be Sisko and his cloaking technology. So eventually it seems to me that there are going to be consequences. And again, that's going to be true in the Invisible Man, that's going to be true in Lord of the Rings. I mean, eventually, you know, the havoc that ability allows one to wreak, it eventually catches up with them because, you know, people become wise to it and, you know, oh, well, you know, it must be Bilbo or, oh, you know, that must be Griffin. And so then that brings the consequences along with it.
Well, I think what's interesting about the way in which the original Ring of Gyges story is told is that the king kind of lives in seclusion, the pre-existing king, not mm-hmm. Gyges the king, but the original king, kind of lives in secrecy, locked in his palace, not exposed to the public. People don't know what he looks like necessarily, right? He's just this faceless, anonymous king. So when the ancestor of Gyges gets the ring and seduces the queen and kills the king, kind of takes his place, no one knows any better. No one's the wiser because no one's ever seen the king, right? Mm-hmm. The king lives over there in the palace somewhere. And so there are really no consequences. So in the case of Sisko and the cloaking device, if it's discoverable eventually that, oh yeah, that must be a Federation signature on that, you know, the fallout from this attack that the Defiant did, then it's not true anonymity in the way that the original Ring of Gyges story is trying to get at.
One of the other examples, Zachary, that you had, and I want to get to this because I think it's interesting, is LaForge and Ro in the next phase. It's a little bit different. They've phased out and are unable to be seen, but their actions have limited consequences as they move about the ship, as they interfere with technology, as they do different things around the ship. They can be detected to a small degree, but obviously they're trying to save the Enterprise because they know that there is, you know, danger afoot for the Enterprise D, and so they're moving about, they're working, trying to prevent the Enterprise from being destroyed.
Yeah, I put this example of the next phase from The Next Generation in the show notes because it's one of the few cases of genuine, you know, personal invisibility that mm-hmm. we see in Star Trek. We don't see that very much, and this is one of the obvious cases that came to mind. I think what's hard about this example, though, is that they're dealing with the crisis at hand. People think they're dead. They're trying to become visible. We don't get to see them in that state outside of a crisis. So they're trying to deal with the crisis at hand so much, we never just get to see what that invisibility power would do to their moral state when that crisis isn't present. Like, you know, I'm trying to imagine an analogous situation. Like, suppose this weren't LaForge and Ro in The Next Generation. Suppose this were over on Voyager and this were Tom and Harry on Voyager, right? Now, suppose Harry's invisible and there's no crisis. You know, they got to get visible eventually, but they're not starving. Maybe people don't think they're dead. Maybe they're just like, oh, boom, we're invisible and it's not a crisis. Like, it's going to last. It's going to end in 10 hours or it's going to end in 24 hours or something. I mean, what kind of mischief would Tom and Harry get into? Like, if there were no emergency and Tom and Harry are wandering around, I could actually kind of semi-realistically imagine Harry Kim peeking in on the Delaney sisters or Seven of Nine in the sonic shower.
Yeah, I can see that.
Now, that's not the nicest thing to say about Harry. Harry's a decent, honorable guy, but he might.
Tom, definitely. Pre-B'Elanna, though. I think post-B'Elanna, Tom...
He's a changed man.
Yeah, he wouldn't do it for fear of getting his nose broken, frankly.
Is that totally unfair to Harry Kim?
Was Voyager ever fair to Harry Kim?
Wait, are you saying that rather than sneaking a peek at Seven of Nine or the Delaney sisters in the sonic shower, he might actually sneak into the captain's ready room and give himself a promotion on her computer?
Then they would know something was wrong. Then they would know. I think Harry's smarter than that. Harry is a good guy. Now, if you want up to no good, I think Tom would definitely be up to no good if he had the ability to personally cloak.
What would he do though? Like, okay, Harry, I think that was an easy one. Sorry, Harry, but what kind of mischief would Tom get to do? You think Tom is more mischievous than Harry? I think actually Tom, it's harder to think of an example of the kind of mischief he might do than Harry in this case. I could see him pulling a practical joke on the doctor of some sort.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
He would prank the doctor like crazy.
Yes. Every chance he got.
That's not the worst moral failing, pranking the doctor, but
yeah, grab his medical tricorder and move it. Yes, he would do stuff like that. There's no doubt about it.
Right. So again, to drive home the Ring of Gyges point, right? This isn't about mischief, right? This is about would you spiral into moral decay?
Who knows what he would have gotten into? I mean, when you talk about Tom, I definitely can see him moving things around in sick bay while the doctor's working, you know, those types of, and that might be some fun fanfic for somebody out there to write, you know, a day in sick bay with Tom somehow gets his hands on a personal cloaking device
the tricorder of Gyges.
The tricorder of Gyges. Again, you're asking the question, is the eventual result going to be some degree of personal moral decay? And I think the answer depends on who has it. I don't think there is just a blanket, you know, cookie cutter answer to this. I think a lot of it depends on who's got it.
Well, I guess I'm trying to think of the interesting cases because I think there are two uninteresting cases involved. One uninteresting case is the case of someone who's already morally questionable, right? You give that person the invisibility ring or the personal cloaking device or a ship with a cloaking device and they're off the rails hog wild, right? Mm-hmm. So the other uninteresting case is someone who's so morally pure that they're not even remotely tempted by the powers of invisibility, cloaking device, Ring of Gyges, personal invisibility cloak, however you want to characterize it. So the ultra noble characters, I'm thinking of Captain Picard. You know, Captain Picard is someone who's not likely to spiral into much moral decay. The interesting characters for me are the ones that are kind of in the middle, but a little more on the side of noble. So the captains that have the obvious faults and the obvious personality flaws, right? You give that person the invisibility ring or the personal cloaking device or the ship with a cloaking device. And at first, you know, there's no difference, right? They got this invisibility thing, but they're, you know, acting very much like they always do. But then when they encounter a crime of opportunity, like, oh, I can do this and I can get away with it because no one can see me. You know, it could be Captain Picard, mm-hmm. You know, beaming down to visit that archaeological site. Go, wow, look what I can do now. Does that lead to the next step and the next step and the next step? Or at a certain point, does the moral fortitude kick in? You go, oh my God, I'm on this destructive path. I better, you know, turn off the cloaking device and go back to my life on the Enterprise.
And I think the easy answer to that question is yes. I mean, Zachary, I think there is a big difference between handing cloaking technology to Jean-Luc Picard and handing cloaking technology to Gul Dukat. I think the results are polar opposite of one another in terms of what kind of regression or de-evolution happens morally and ethically in that person's life. And for that matter, if you don't want to draw such extremes, let's take two groups of you know, within the Federation. You know, let's take Jean-Luc Picard and say any random member of the Maquis. Michael mm-hmm. Eddington. Let's take Sisko and Michael Eddington, and give them each cloaking technology. Is Sisko going to push some boundaries? You bet he is. Michael Eddington, on the other hand, is going to do something that probably most people would feel is morally and ethically wrong in order to accomplish his objective of independence from this treaty with the Cardassians. He's going to kill people with it.
So if there's a genuine difference between giving a cloaking device to Captain Picard versus giving a cloaking device to Michael Eddington versus giving a cloaking device to Gul Dukat, if that's a real difference where the outcomes will be very different,
yes,
what accounts for the difference? I think you could run through a few different hypotheses on what the difference is. You could say that there is an innate personality or a temperament difference. I mean, this Plato thought very much something along these lines. He thought there were people with different temperaments. You know, some people were, you know, had a temperament to be a ruler, and some people had a temperament to be a soldier, and some people had a temperament to do this, that, and the other thing. He was mm-hmm. not an egalitarian. He didn't think of people as being innately equal like we think of them here in a democratic society. He thought people just had different natures, and that dictated to some extent their ideal status in society. Some people were naturally more moral than others. So if you give a cloaking device to two of those people, yeah, some are going to, you know, experience this moral decay, and some are going to be able to maintain their nobility and maintain their moral behavior because they have different innate natures. Someone like Aristotle, by contrast, would say that their experiences and their habits are different, right? They've been trained differently. Gul Dukat's experience and his upbringing and his training and his habits are very different than those of Captain Picard. And the training and the habits and the experience of Michael Eddington are very different than the training and habits and experience of Captain Picard. And so that is what accounts for the difference, not their innate natures. When we're asking the difference between species, we can ask, it's an interesting question. Is there a genuine species difference between Romulans and Klingons and humans in this regard? We talked about that at the beginning of the show, but I think it's not obvious at all what the cause of the difference is, even if there's a genuine difference between giving a cloaking device to one person or another person or another or a member of another race in Star Trek.
And Star Trek postulates, Zachary, I think pretty convincingly that even given the temperament of a person, one's surroundings, one's atmosphere, one's experiences inform the morality and the ethics of the person. So we talked about, you know, the difference between giving it to, say, Picard and Michael Eddington, but what about Picard and Shinzon? Again, I think we have two completely different outcomes, you know, and Shinzon had that technology.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to, you know, devolve the whole Ring of Gaiju's debate into a nature versus nurture debate,
sure.
But that's what we have going on with Shinzon and Captain Picard, right? In some sense, their innate nature is similar because they have similar biology, right? They mm-hmm. are the same. They have the same biological raw materials. I mean, Captain Picard says as much inside Star Trek Nemesis. You know, we have the same potential, you and I, right? But Shinzon has very different experiences as a result of his time being a Romulan prisoner, hanging out with the Remans. So in that case, it's not easy at all to tell, you know, which parts of Captain Picard's versus Shinzon's reactions are a result of their innate nature. You know, they're, you know, and Shinzon kind of pokes fun at Picard's nobility, this Picard mm-hmm. nobility, right? He's almost mocking it. But there's something to that there's some people just seem to have this innate character about them. It's easier for them to do good, to do right, to be noble than it is for other people to do those things. Mm-hmm. And it's a genuine mystery, I think, why some people just seem to have a more natural inclination to do good and do right and be moral creatures. And some people seem to really struggle with it and everything in between. But Shinzon, the difference between Shinzon and Picard really, you know, brings that to the forefront. I just think it's not easy at all to tell what's at play, their innate nature versus their different experiences. But undoubtedly, if you gave, I think we can agree that if you gave a cloaking device to Captain Picard and gave one to Shinzon, the outcomes would be very different. But I don't think it's easy at all to know exactly what accounts for the difference, even when you have the same biological raw materials.
Okay. I think there's a danger here of kind of going into, you know, a nature versus nurture debate, but I think there is some obvious answers there, I think, or conclusions that we can draw. And I think to some degree, Star Trek draws those conclusions as well. But when we're talking about, you know, what is somebody going to do? Is morality something that is innately part of who we are? Or is it something that is instilled in us as we move along through life? I think that debate is really at the heart of the question, what is somebody going to do if they're given the Ring of Gyges, or in our case, in our Star Trek universe example, you know, a cloaking device?
I think there's something ingenious to Aristotle's take on human nature as opposed to Plato's, as opposed to Glaucon's perspective inside the Republic. Aristotle thinks morality is a matter of cultivating the right habits, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not just a matter of education. It's not like you're being imparted with all these moral codes and these moral rules and you just kind of soak it up and now you're a moral creature.
Right.
For Aristotle, it's a matter of training, forming the right habits that when in a certain kind of situation, you naturally develop this habit of reacting a certain way to avoid that moral decay, as if through repeated conscious effort of doing the right thing and acting morally and, you know, thinking about justice and being part of a civilized society, you can shield yourself against the temptations of evil. You know, as if someone came along and said, here's your invisibility ring, you know, if you've had the right habits and the right training and, you know, developed the right character traits, you would go, no, that's probably not a good idea. You can actually sort of form this barrier around yourself by cultivating the right habits. And that's the difference. And Captain Picard has cultivated a moral barrier, right, through all of his training and experience and habit formation. It's not just education. It's not like he was taught it all when he was young and he soaked it all in and now he's moral, right? He's over his entire life and his entire career formed habits of morality. And so when the temptation comes along, he knows better and he's not seduced by that. And I think this is what I see in the power of the Tolkien version of this with the One Ring in the Lord of the Rings trilogy. That seductive power of the evil in the Lord of the Rings is something you can kind of shield yourself off against by developing the right habits. So, you know, if someone came along and said, here, Captain Picard, here's a ship with a cloaking device. You can, you know, rape, pillage, and plunder and go visit as many archaeological sites as you want to. He would go, no, that's not wise for a great many reasons. And his experience and his training and his habit formation has allowed him to very naturally and habitually reject that temptation.
And I think we see that, and again, I can think of a dozen different examples of Captain Picard being presented with the opportunity to wield power of one type or another, and him, you know, more or less push himself away from the table and say, you know, no, I'm not gonna drink the Kool-Aid, and we see that. I think it's a matter of and instilling a cultivation of values. I think it has to do with one's worldview. I mean, it really gets at the heart of what you and I do every week. We talk about Star Trek and philosophy. I think that's why philosophy is such an important thing for people to invest the time and effort into studying, even if I'm not saying that everybody should, you know, go off to a university and study philosophy, Zachary. That's certainly not what I'm suggesting. But rather, I think philosophy is a lifelong pursuit of understanding, and I think that understanding informs our sense of morality. I think it informs our worldview. I think it informs our values. And at the end of the day, our worldview and our values are the things that are going to dictate our actions.
I think you're right. I think there's some value in continuing to think about the nature of justice and the nature of morality and these difficult cases. What if you had this invisibility ring, blah, 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 these sort of hypothetical thought experiments. Because what they do, they keep morality top of mind, right? If you're not thinking about what's right and what's wrong, what's just and what's not, it's very easy to just react based on your passions and your desires and your gut reactions rather than really thinking through, is this really just? Is this really moral? And I think philosophy training, you know, at its best can help you achieve those things or at least keep them top of mind in a way that they wouldn't be if you're not actively thinking about it. By extension, insofar as Star Trek is really philosophy put in science fiction, honestly, and this is not an exaggeration, I think you get an awful lot of moral training by watching Star Trek and seeing again and again the moral failings and the moral virtues of the various characters and races we see in Star Trek. Those are really a reflection of us. So if you take time to think about those examples, then when an analogous situation comes along here in the real world, you can literally go, oh, that's like that thing I saw in Star Trek, and I know the right thing to do is blah, 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 because I've already thought about it, because I've seen that a million times in that episode of Star Trek. Likewise, in philosophy, you can go, oh, that's like that example in the Ring of Gyges, and blah, 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 so I'm going to do the right thing here in the real world. Now, in reality, none of us is perfect, and we do right things and wrong things, and for most of us, it's somewhere in the middle. You know, sometimes we're closer to being moral, and sometimes we're less close to being moral, but what I think it's important to keep morality and virtue top of mind, because if you don't, then you can really be susceptible to moral decay. If you keep those concepts and those examples, you know, in the front of your brain versus the back of your brain, you know, then you're I think you're better prepared to recognize dangerous situations when they come along. Now, none of us is perfect, but again, in the Aristotelian sense, I think it's a matter of training that by thinking about those things habitually, those concepts and the examples, whether, you know, historical examples or fictional examples or mythological examples or science fiction examples in Star Trek, that should help prepare you for examples that you'll run across in the real world.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the reasons why it's important to cultivate a love of reading. You mentioned, you know, sitting down and watching Star Trek, and for a philosopher, it might be, you know, the Ring of Gyges. For someone in religious circles, for the Christian, it might be spending time in devotions, reading the Bible, drawing these moral ideas out of, you know, these stories that are within the Bible. It might be sitting down and reading some H.G. Wells or some Tolkien, what, you know, C.S. Lewis, whatever the case may be, and really thinking through the concepts that are being presented. I love good book studies and having conversations about things that are in books, because these conversations, they challenge my way of thinking. They change the way I think. I mean, even in doing this podcast now for the last year and a half has really in many ways challenged some of my thinking on things. It's reinforced some ideas that I have about the world around me. And in some ways, it's informed some changes that I've made. And again, I think this is why these kinds of conversations are important, because we do need to keep top of mind. And I think within the Star Trek universe, you know, we see them put to the test. We see them presented problems and having to make decisions and stepping back and thinking through. I mean, a Geordi in his PowerPoint, or, you know, it might be, you know, sitting in the wardroom talking, you know, talking out a plan to, you know, come up with a way to solve the problem. They're working together. They're talking through. They're learning. They're growing as individuals. And isn't that what really this is all about?
I actually love the idea, and I'm only half joking, that someone out there is having their weekly Metatrex devotional, and we are the last shield of defense when someone is being offered the very tempting tricorder of Gyges.
Yes, because we know that tricorder can seduce one to mischief of all kinds.
Yeah, I at the risk of delving into personal experience here, and my personal experience bears this out, I don't know if yours does too, but my experience has been that evil is very seductive and it's always waiting there in the shadows. That unless you kind of shield yourself against the various temptations and the various evils out there in the world, that it's very easy to put yourself on a path where you're not being the best version of yourself. And you really need to kind of shield yourself from it. Again, not by retreating, not by being afraid, but by developing proper habits of action so that when those temptations come along, if someone came along and said, here's this invisibility ring, go wild, you'll know better and you'll know the right things to do, and you won't, and you can rely on your habits of action rather than being tempted unnecessarily by the evil that's out there.
Well, Zachary, one of the examples that we gave as we had this discussion, you know, we've mentioned the TNG episode, The Pegasus, and in particular, Captain Pressman. And I think he's really an interesting character in that Riker respected him. And I think that there was probably a time in Pressman's life when he was, to some degree, I think, a Captain Picard-esque type captain. Maybe a bit more emotionally involved. Like,
until
say,
he got that cloaking
Sisko.
Device.
Well, I don't think it maybe necessarily was the cloaking device. I have a tendency to think that oftentimes in people's lives, when they end up going down the wrong path and they have this kind of moral crisis in which they've done something just horribly immoral, I don't think it starts with that horribly immoral act. I think it's one small decision in the wrong direction, one step in the wrong direction. There's a song that talks about it being a slow fade, and I think there's a lot of truth to that. And I'm curious.
I know the song. That's a great song.
That is a great song. And it really paints an interesting picture, you know, being careful to take the right steps, because too many steps in the wrong direction lead to, you know, horrible consequences. And I think that's true for Pressman. There was probably a time in his life when he was an upright, good, decent captain. I think that was true for Captain Ranson in Voyager. I think that was true, you know, as we look at, you know, different characters in the Star Trek universe making bad decisions and ending up in a place of moral bankruptcy. I don't think it starts there. I think it starts with one step in the wrong direction, one bad decision, and then you take another step and another step and another step until you are morally and ethically bankrupt.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think the quick version of the Ring of Gyges story in Plato's Republic doesn't really do it justice, because, you know, the way it's quickly told is, you know, this ancestor of Gyges gets this ring and then he seduces the queen and murders the king, right? There's no middle ground there. Much more realistically, if someone got an invisibility ring, they'd start to test the waters, you know, and they'd start peeking in a window, or they'd steal a grain of rice and see if they can get away with that. And that leads to something that's a little worse, and that leads to something a little worse. And before you know it, you're seducing the queen and murdering the king, right? Mm-hmm. And there's all this interesting stuff in the middle about these innocuous steps that seem really harmless, but put you on this destructive path that you don't realize until you're already on it.
Yeah. When we meet Pressman in the Pegasus, I think he has taken step after step after step. And now he has this opportunity to get, you know, that cloaking device back from Pegasus. And he is so driven. He is so morally bankrupt. He is so far removed from the principles for which Starfleet was founded upon that he even looks at what he's doing, at least the case that he tries to make to Riker, is that this is the right thing to do. This is, and we kind of made that point earlier on in the discussion, but I think it's important to bring it up at this point that that kind of power, I mean, to the Romulan, you know, having the ability to sneak up and get the drop, that probably seems like a good thing to them. To Chang, it probably seems like a good, honorable thing to sit there with, you know, with the cloak on and take shot after shot after shot, spinning around in his chair like a madman, having his way with Captain Kirk and the Enterprise.
Well, Captain Ransom in that episode of Voyager Equinox basically says as much. He basically says, look, it all started so innocently. You know, mm-hmm. the creature was dead and, you know, we found we could use it as this energy source. And before you know it, they're killing and hunting these creatures to the point where he doesn't even see it as wrong anymore. And I think that's an interesting progression from these innocuous, seemingly innocuous steps that are wrong, but not very wrong, to progressively worse actions, to these horrific actions, to the point where even the horrific actions look like the right thing to do. And you don't even see them as horrific actions. And you can see that in the Ring of Gaiji story, right? From, you know, finding the invisibility ring to peeking in windows and stealing grains of rice to progressively worse things to, you know, seducing the queen and murdering the king. But even that's wrong, right? You're doing something wrong to the point where once you've assumed the identity of the king, you kind of forget that the whole thing ever happened. You would just end up assuming the identity of the king, right? You are the king now. And it's the right thing. You just view yourself as the king in that situation, I think. And it's almost like moral obfuscation. The line between right and wrong gets reversed or blurred, where things that are obviously wrong end up looking like the right thing to do because you've been so seduced and twisted by this progressively worse chain of events to where at the end of that chain, you don't even see evil as evil or wrong as wrong. What is actually evil or wrong in reality ends up looking right, you know, to the person in that situation.
So basically it's a de-evolution to the mirror universe where everybody has goatees and invisibility cloaks.
And at the end of that spectrum, you grow a goatee. Well, Mike, it seems like in the course of our discussion, we've agreed on a few things. I think we've agreed on the fact that this invisibility idea, whether it's a ring or whether it's a cloaking device, has the potential to lead to some sort of moral decay. Some people, through cultivating, you know, the right habits of morality and strong character, can kind of shield themselves against that. But a lot of people aren't able to do so. And once you've taken that first step, it's very easy to take the next step and take the next step and end up in a place, you know, similar to what we see in the Ring of Gyges, you know, doing these terrible things like murdering the king and taking his identity, or in the case of Captain Ransom, you know, killing and hunting alien creatures, not even seeing that as wrong, right? There's these easy, innocuous first steps that has the potential to lead to very bad things. And we've talked about that quite a bit now. But I guess if invisibility, this idea of anonymity, being able to cower in darkness and shadows and get away with things, if that is problematic, it's plausible to ask, well, what's the opposite of that? Is the opposite of that any better, right? Suppose it were possible not just to hide in darkness, but for everyone to be visible all the time and have no privacy, no darkness, no mm-hmm. shadows. And there are several thought experiments about this in fiction and in philosophy. The one that comes to mind from philosophy is Jeremy Bentham's notion of a panopticon. And a panopticon is this kind of hypothetical prison that you could keep prisoners in, where they're, you know, kind of arranged in a circle where there's this all-seeing eye in the middle of this circular-shaped prison. So all the prisoners they don't have any privacy. They're visible all the time. So there's mm-hmm. no problem with the prisoners being under control. There's no privacy. There's no way to get away with anything because they're constantly being seen. The example that comes to mind from fiction would be something like 1984, Big Brother is watching you. Even yes. the televisions are watching you. But heck, we've had that in the news happen this week, right?
Yes.
You know, through the WikiLeaks stuff, we found out that the CIA has the ability to hack into people's smart TVs and and use them as microphones, right? Hopefully selectively. But this idea, well, if privacy is bad, and if it's easy for evil to hide in the darkness and the shadows, what if there are no darkness and shadows? What if everyone's visible all the time? Would the absolute lack of privacy and lack of invisibility assure our moral status any better than invisibility would?
Well, Zachary, that's an interesting question. And you mentioned 1984, and I think we're seeing this theme crop up more and more in fiction, but in truth, it's a part of our reality. I mean, we live in an age of surveillance. We have the ability to look just about on every street corner in America at any given time. I can take a shot of my living room and look in on what's going on. It's part of my, part of my home security system.
I have a confession to make, Mike. Okay. I can see your podcast studio.
and I can see yours. But
you better act morally over there.
We're living, watching you. Yes, yes. We're living in this age of surveillance, and there are people who don't believe that our government can handle that kind of technology. And they worry about people having the ability to look in on them when they're in the privacy of their own homes, and rightly so. Because I think it opens up lots of questions about you know, morality and ethics that I think, frankly, we need to talk about as a society as we become, you know, more and more linked to this worldwide web and this ability to survey our homes and our streets. And, you know, science fiction has really become science fact.
Well, let me ask you a question. I'm not sure whether I'm asking this in a very good way, but I'm going to throw it out there because I can't think of a better way to ask it. I think we've learned from the Ring of Gaiju's example, and by extension, the cloaking device examples that we've talked about in Star Trek, that where there is invisibility, where there's anonymity, mm-hmm. there's potential for wrongdoing, bad behavior, immorality, whatnot. Mm-hmm. Is it plausible that from the perspective of an all-seeing government, you know, with the ability to hack through people's smart TVs and tap into people's cameras and whatnot, mm-hmm. that where there's privacy, where there's a lack of visibility, there is inherently going to be something to discover that is worth investigating?
Again, I think in some cases the answer might be yes. But, you know, in other cases, for instance, you know, we call it intense fellowship around my house when my wife and I disagree about something. You know, I think in almost 23 years of marriage, we've only had a couple of what I would consider to be fights. I mean, we disagree about things. We irritate each other occasionally, and we have, again, I call it intense fellowship occasionally. And, you know, I wouldn't want that to be available out there for anybody to tap into and watch, because, you know, it's not always the best version of myself. It's not always the best version of herself. Am I doing anything horrible or immoral? No, but, you know, it's not necessarily always the best version of me. I can say mean things occasionally, and I can be critical. I'm not a perfect person. Am I necessarily immoral or bad? No, but definitely not always the best version of me.
I know everyone's relationship is different, and I understand that. So, you know, when I talk about these things, you know, I'm not putting a blanket on anyone else's relationship. But you and I have talked about this a little bit, and I think generally it's a decent principle that cloaking devices aren't good in a relationship. That the more transparent you are, and the more, you know, the fewer kind of secret dark corners of one's life that there are, the more likely you are to have a healthy relationship. So that's my advice. From cloaking devices are bad in a relationship.
Yeah, there's a reason why we don't exchange the ring of Gyges in wedding ceremonies.
Right. Well, there's something to this idea that if you're actively seeking out privacy or the darkness and the shadows, then, you know, at the risk of just painting everything with, you know, blanket terminology here and overgeneralizing, I think my experience has been that truth and goodness prefer the light, and evil things prefer the darkness and shadows and privacy. And there are good things that happen in privacy, and there are bad things that happen in public. There's lots of exceptions, but the tendency is that, you know, the good and virtuous things tend to like living in the light, and the evil things like living in the darkness.
Yeah, I think generally speaking, that's a true statement. I think that's a true statement. I think anyone out there who is a student of philosophy would agree that there are philosophical precedents for that. Anyone who is a theological student out there, certainly there are theological precedents for that. It's a very, in terms of a biblical principle, it's a biblical principle.
And I think there are exceptions. There are the truly evil people in the world that have done their evil from a mountaintop for all to see, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's the people that do goodness, you know, quietly and without praise, and they don't get any thanks for it, and they're doing it relatively anonymously. And so, you know, there are good things that happen in private, and there are bad things that happen out in public. But generally, in terms of overall tendencies, I think good things tend to happen out there for the world to see, and the evil in the world likes to lurk in the shadows. But
yeah, I agree. I think that's a fair statement.
So turn off those cloaking devices and travel the stars for all the galaxy to see.
Yes. Boldly go, loud and proud.
Well, Mike, it's been fun talking about the ethics of invisibility and cloaking devices, but this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week, so here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
I open up the garment bag and I see this like red tunic, like this top, and like, wait, this looks really familiar. Like, so I try it all on, I try on all the wardrobe, everything fits great, and I look at myself in the mirror, I'm like, holy bleep. And I turned to the wardrobe supervisor. I said, is this Star Trek that I'm working on?
To the journey!
Leola is a substitute for any ingredient he doesn't have.
No sugar, Leola root.
Yeah. No bananas, Leola root.
No coffee,
Leola root.
Saturday morning Trek.
Roddenberry was very involved with the first episode. And for that episode, we needed to come up with the derelict spaceship. And as a result, as the brand new guy on the crew who had spaceships and stuff in his portfolio, I got the job of coming up with that ship.
Stage 9, a podcast about the people who make Star Trek.
I mean, obviously, you have Nicholas Meyer writing for your Star Trek show. Is there any way that they're not going to be like, hey, Nick, you want to direct an episode? Because, I mean, like, would they... I mean, I cannot see any scenario in which they'd be like, I don't know, man. I don't know if he's right for this gig.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly, and it makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, and now also on Google Play and YouTube. And, of course, you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network through Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats in our content development team, and many more. We really appreciate any support you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. Sorry. Ran out of breath there. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything we discussed in this episode of MetaTrek, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via a form on Trek FM's website. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
You can also leave us a voicemail. Just look in the sidebar of the show page or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
On Twitter, you can find us under the handle @trekfm.
You can also catch us on Facebook. It's facebook.com/trekfm. And while you're there, be sure to check out the Babel Conference. That's Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group. Just simply type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar. It's a closed group, but if you click to join, one of our admins will let you right on in.
We also invite you to leave a rating and a review of MetaTrek on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. Well, Mike, when you're not podcasting in darkness and shadows, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, Zachary, you can find me around Facebook. That's where I'm most active, certainly in the Babel Conference. On Twitter, my Twitter handle is @cmichael1701. I'm also on Instagram, cmichael1701. And if you'd like to read my blog, my thoughts about publishing and a little bit about life, that is wordpress.com/cmichael1701. And Zachary, when you're not playing tricks on the EMH using the tricorder of Gyges, where can our listeners find you around the network and on the interwebs?
Well, you can find me elsewhere on the Trek FM network as co-host of Trek FM's Voyager podcast, To the Journey, along with my co-hosts there, Suzanne Williamson and Kay Shaw. You can also find me in the Babel Conference if you want to talk about Star Trek and philosophy with me there. And you can always find me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, at Zachary Fruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. Well, we'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the Metatrex team from the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, the founder and publisher of Trek.fm, our executive producers, Matthew Rushing and Kenneth Tripp, Aaron Harvey, our art director, Richard Marquez, our production manager, and Brandon Shea Mutala, our Patreon manager. And we'd like to give a special thank you and a shout out to our three associate producers for Metatrex. We'd like to thank Patrick Devlin. You can find him under the Twitter handle at MagicDrop5. We'd like to thank Kay Shaw, who likes to talk Voyager with me sometimes over on To the Journey. You can find her under the Twitter handle at ChocoWeeble. And we'd like to thank Kit Lofstadt. You can find her under the handle at MotherCat, and that's Mother with a zero. Well, everyone, thanks for listening to Metatrex, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.